So does anybody have anything that they've ever done that was, that they think of as being unconventional and working with their dog that actually worked? Can you think of any?
You mean the method or just things that
worked? Yeah, things that worked. So I'm having a really embarrassing example. Okay, so Aspen is an alarm barker. And she's especially an alarm barker when she's at home and comfortable in her house. And she sees a bird outside or hears a noise outside or whatever. And we have tried a wide variety of different behavior modification methods to try to stop this behavior. The most successful has always been call her back immediately, have her sit, do a treat. Because, as you know, she works for treats. But we would really rather not do that because we'd really rather not do that. Nobody's like that, right? So it's like one of my clients say things like, well, I don't want to take treats. And I go, I'm sorry, but that's not what you want to do. Because you're either going to have to do that or you're going to have to yell and scream with your dog and that won't do any good. So, you know, this week when she barked, because she barks when I come home and she barks when Tricia comes home. It's not like she just, you know, and then she stands there barking and you're like, I'm me. I'm here. I've never had a dog that did this before. I've had dogs that bark, but they always stop immediately and they go, oh, hi, it's you. But she's like barking, keeps on barking. So we had a discussion and I told her, I said, you know, Aspen, you really don't need to do this. So we just sat down and talked and she's been way better since then. Not perfect, but definitely way better. So I'm just asking you, you know, is there anything that you guys might do that you think? I mean, this was a funny one, but people do. Oh, here's another example, just to show you what I'm talking about. Just thinking outside the, not only the box, outside of everything, right? So years ago, I was working with this woman who had a dog with separation anxiety. And the separation anxiety was really bad to the extent that she was not able to leave her home. So she came for a consult. And we did some follow-up work and whatnot, and I gave her just the normal protocols of everything that we were doing at the time, which is, you know, cool departures, warm arrivals, you only go out a little bit at a time, you try to make sure that the dog is comfortable, you give them a goodbye gift, you know, the whole kit and caboodle of the stuff that you do with the dog with separation anxiety. And she came back 3 or 4 months later, as she was signing up for a class, and I said, oh, did any of that stuff work? And she said, no. She said, what I did worked. And I said, so what did you did? And so she said, what I did was, I put her by, and this, by the way, is the stuff that I use now. But she put her by the door, she had her look out the window, and then she said, I'll be right back, I am going to the store. When I go to the store, I'm going to get you some cookies. They'll be really, really good cookies. So I want you to wait here by the door while I go to the store. I'm going to take the car and then I'm going to come back again, okay? And she did that and she went out and she goes all the way out, goes to the car, goes in, get to the store, comes back with some cookies for the dog and the dog is fine. So I'm going, this is really good. I want to do this when I grow up. I later on, I kind of figured out why it worked, or why it worked according to science. So the thing that made it work were, first of all, that she was very, very sure of herself. This is what I'm going to, and that makes the dog's anxiety level drops. Because most of the time, when a dog is anxious, if we have to act anxious too, then the dog gets much worse. Then secondly, she gave the dog some instructions. And she actually did some do as I do. Because she said, I want you to sit here, I'm going to go out there, and then I'm going to come right back in again. And it is something that I've used consistently since then, but it is not something that you will ever find in any of the books about anything, right? Because in this case, this is actually communicating with your dog. I want you to do this, and I will do that. So I ask again, anybody have to do anything odd with their dogs that actually worked? Yes?
I had a similar thing with the separation anxiety. I built her a little window seat. So she could, because she only would be trying to get out and eat her way through the door that I left by. So I built a window seat by that door, because fortunately it was a window. And then I go out, and she can see me get in the car and say, yeah, I'm getting in the car.
So you're actually showing her, demonstrating what you're doing.
I came back and forth, did that a lot. And so whether I walked or whether I went out in the car, she could see me. It was the same thing. I would go back, and, you know, and she then would just wait in that spot. For, sometimes, a couple hours.
Oh, the starter would wait on his perch for 4 to 5 hours, but it gave him a job,
yeah.
And his job was to do that, and that was a fine thing. That was, I mean, it's much better than racing around the house, barking like crazy, being terrified that you're never going to come back again. So, you know, what you did is you actually, I guess what I'm getting at is communicating with your dog. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times what people do is they think of the dog as the other. Right? So what you're doing when you're communicating with your dog is you're saying, hi, I want this. How do I tell the dog to do that? And what I'm trying to get at is communicating, talking across to your dog. He's your colleague, he's your companion, and just kind of saying, this is where I'm coming from, and I wish you to join me in where I'm coming from. And I know that it's not in any scientific literature whatsoever, but that I think it's a really good way to deal with our dogs. Don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of things like separation anxiety and German Shepherds, we're gonna go into the protective dogs. And I've got here the German Shepherd and the Belgian Malinois, which are the protecting herding dogs. In a bit, we're gonna go back and do some of the other protective dogs. It'll come after the bullies, I think. But because German Shepherds are so everywhere, they were a couple of years ago vying, well, in our area it seemed like, particularly when we were down in Santa Cruz, the most popular dogs were German Shepherds, Huskies, Pit Bulls, and Chihuahuas. Those were the big four, I think. I don't know if that's true up here.
In Monterey
it is, right?
Yeah,
Huskies became very popular for some obscure reason. And then people somehow found out that they're not necessarily the best house dog in the world. So they're kind of lowering down again. But German Shepherds have always been up there because people think of them as being, you know, the all-around great dog. And a lot of them are the all-around great dog.
There's a breeder in San Jose, too.
Yeah, there's a breeder up here that is, she took Westminster years ago. And she is, or they, I guess, it's two people. They are, I would say, double-handedly or single-handedly responsible for most of the hip dysplasia that's around in our German Shepherds here. Because their dogs have that real, that look like this. And it won, unfortunately, at Westminster. Oh yeah, very reactive. So just taking the Malinois first. Malinois started as a herding dog in Belgium, along with the Tervuren and the black dog, the sheepdog. But they kind of have taken a different turn over the years, and they are now the most popular German working dog for police and also for Schutzhund work. And the reason is because they're so driven. They are extremely hardy. They can take all kinds of damage. Unfortunately, I mean, that's not necessarily a good thing, but they can, and they are very tenacious, very, very tenacious. They've got what we call work ethic. So if you talk to a lot of people who breed or work with Schutzhund dogs or high-level training dogs, they're always talking about a work ethic. And essentially that means the dog will work past all kinds of other things. So they don't need treats to work. They don't need you to tell them they're a good dog to work. They work because they want to work and they need to work. And the biggest issue with these dogs is when you don't have anything for them to do because they have this tremendous need to work. They can be very, very challenging, although I'm told that they're also satisfying. I would never have one myself. I don't have enough energy. I want dogs that can relax when I relax and be energetic when I want them to be energetic. They are definitely prone to OCD behaviors. Because if you think about it, what OCD behaviors are is, you know, it's cyclical behaviors that just won't go away, spinning or chasing lights or chasing shadows or whatever. And that often starts off with an excess in energy and then kind of goes into, this is the way they're burning it off. So you'll see that particularly with spinning. They're burning off all that anxious energy. And they, if they are understimulated, they almost all will. I was talking this week to a person that I know who works with the high drive dogs, and she is a very high drive person. So I think it's wonderful that she's working with them. It's just a shame that a lot of people get these dogs and don't realize what they've gotten. Dutch Shepherds, which are now becoming somewhat popular, are pretty much the same. They look a lot like Malinois. They are a little bit bulkier. I didn't put a picture in here, sorry. They're a little bit bulkier. They kind of a mottled color, but they have the same kind of temperament. And of course, I like them a lot, but I'm not terribly sure that I would ever want one. This is just a funny little video. So you really want a Malinois. It's definitely very short. Whoops, come on. Loading photos. What now? There it is.
Are you okay?
I was looking for high drive Malinois videos. I got this off of YouTube. Came across this one, just thought it was really funny. You know, we've got the lights off here, so if anybody ever does go back and watch this on video, you're going to see me as a big shadow, because I don't appear to have any kind of facial features at all, which is okay with me. I'm fine with that. Okay, so German Shepherds are different and the same. So the difference is that Malinois are extremely driven. They're not very sensitive. German Shepherds, like Belgian Treviranes, and the Black Dogs as well, are overly sensitive. I mean, if you raise your eyebrow, they're like, "Oh my God!" Until they discover that there's something that they need to do, which might be to bark at another dog. And once you do that, then you've lost them forever. One of the idiosyncrasies. How many people here have or have had a German Shepherd? Okay, so one of the biggest things that I've seen with that, and if you train one or whatever, is that they are very bad with eye contact. They're great with eye contact in the home with you, but as soon as they go out into the real world, they do not look at you. They are looking at absolutely everything else, and the reason they're doing that is because they are scanning the environment. So they're definitely environmentally aware at all times. They are, despite the fact that they don't look at their owners a lot, they are extremely attached to their owners and totally prone to separation anxiety. They are one of the most commonly, they're most one of the common breeds that has social separation anxiety, along with Huskies. Very, very common to have separation anxiety with Huskies. I think they come from a different source. This is just me speaking. I think that with German Shepherds, it's because they get very attached to their owner or owners. And I think with Huskies, it's because they are so pack-oriented, they don't want to be alone. I know Strider had separation anxiety when he was separated from me. So he could be with my husband, he could be with my daughter, he could be with anybody else, and he would still have separation anxiety. So that was all an attachment to me. And believe me, you don't want that, because it makes living very hard. Because he always wanted to be right where I was. They're responsive to their owner's moods. Again, this is a double-edged sword. If you have a German Shepherd with reactive issues and you're walking along and you get nervous, he'll get nervous. Because he's responsive to your moods, he's reading you all the time. I did work with one client this week. She has a Airedale, and she's a somewhat elderly person, and the Airedale is quite young. And it was very interesting. And then an Airedale is a pretty protective breed. It was interesting that she would get nervous when she'd see another dog coming, and as soon as she did, it just traveled right down the leash. And so I was trying to point out to her what was going on. And she understands it intellectually, but to try to translate that into her physical self is really, really difficult. So we're walking in a place, luckily there's a place in Marin where most people who walk their dogs walk little dogs, and the Airedale doesn't respond to little dogs. And they all walk slowly. So this is good, because it means that we can work under her threshold all the time, and the woman can start working on her the way she holds her leash. German Shepherds are extremely territorial, and again, you know, 99% of dogs are really territorial, but some of them excel at it. And German Shepherds are one of the breeds that really does excel at this particular thing. I had a client a long time ago whose dog was just a gem, really a great dog, but he was so territorial that he smashed out of the front door, through the screen door, and went after a guy and his daughter who were getting into their car across the street. So that territoriality had really gone into the rest of the neighborhood. So he had expanded it himself. Their play behavior can be rough unless you actually work with it a lot, and they are often predatory. I do remember one client I had with a predatory German Shepherd that they lived in a studio apartment in Oakland. Really nice people. They'd just gotten this very large German Shepherd, and they had a cat, and they wanted the dog and the cat to get along. And at the end of an hour and a half, where we were all sweating profusely because it was so hard to hold this dog, my recommendation was to return the dog. I don't know whether she did. A lot of people return the cat or don't keep the cat. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it happens all the time. They get a dog, and all of a sudden, the cat's like chopped liver.
The cat was there first.
Cat lived there first. You know, for me, there's no question about it. But for them, apparently, I guess that has to do with how attached they are to their cat, I suppose, when you get down to it. Okay, so this is a young German Shepherd. She's probably about 7 months old. She's meeting Boo, our Aussie, who passed away. And you can watch the reactivity. And this is very, very German Shepherd. Again, you'll see it in other breeds. There's no behavior that you're not going to see the cross breeds. But there are some where it just will pop up again and again and again and again. And this is what you'll see with her. Boo is wonderful. So every time she notices him, probably 14 at this point, so he wasn't noticing it a lot. She's good for people, but we're really worried about the reaction. She sort of is. Yeah, they're absolutely. These behaviors have been exacerbated over the last 20, 25 years. You didn't used to see it. And remember, they breed really quickly. So generations can pass. And what I was saying last week about the fact that if somebody's a big winner at Westminster, their sperm goes everywhere. And then guess what? Now you have a bunch of dogs with this behavior profile. And people don't know where it came from.
And they're genetic nightmares now.
Oh, I know. They really are. They're a mess. I would never not have another one.
No, I wouldn't.
What you looking for?
Where's her bed? Aspen's bed.
Was her bed? I think I forgot to put it down. Oh my God. I don't know. I've got to change that.
Is this one a white one?
It's actually, there is a blue one, but you can certainly use the white one or whatever. You know, she actually has a lot of padding. She could probably just lie on the floor. Okay, so the behavior problems, if I'm given a call by a, if I get a call from somebody who has a German Shepherd, the likelihood is that I'm going to get leash reactivity, generalized anxiety, and separation anxiety. That's what I'm kind of plan on when I see the dog. Now, that doesn't mean that that's all they get, but I have to say, I'm trying to think if I've seen very many dogs, maybe one or possibly two mixes with a lot of German Shepherd in them, that have human aggression. Most of them are dog reactivity and anxiety oriented. I don't see, anybody here know a German Shepherd? Yeah, with a...
Yeah, some people in my neighborhood adopted, they had a really nice shepherd and they adopted another one, and he was just creepy. He'd be like, hi, like, look at him, kind of, and he just full hard stare, close up, just like, and growled at me in the face one time, and I had been working with a trainer, but he's like, they never told me about that behavior.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, we have a human aggression of someone in Monterey, a couple of them, pretty bad. I mean, they'll want the treatment and then
Oh, well, that's a different thing.
Oh, no, it wasn't like snatching it fast. Like
no, not that I know.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The, give me a treat. Give me a treat.
Yeah.
Give me. And that's a problem with positive reinforcement training. I want the treat now. What do you mean I'm not going to get another one? I want it now. So you see this kind of behavior, and I could see a German Shepherd.
Walking people too, you know, if they're walking by.
Yeah. Oh, that pass by bike. Yeah, for sure. You see that the herding dog thing, where it's like get it's kind of the don't let the door hit you on the way out bike.
Yeah.
You get that. So I take it back. I've seen quite a bit of that. I just don't see as much overt reactivity with people as I do with dogs. Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
So when you're talking about, how you're talking about people are breeding for physical traits and it's changing other things in the dog.
Yeah.
So in addition to breeding dogs that, the epigenetics of that issue, is it also because they're breeding for these particular looks and then it's changing, or is it mostly just the genetic part? So you said the last 20, 25 years, they just...
Oh, that's epigenetics. And I mean, that's actually, epigenetics would be the breeding.
Yeah.
Right? That would be it.
Right.
That's part of it. It's the experience and any kind of genetic manipulation that you do ends up causing the behaviors of a generation much more quickly than you would expect using Darwinian genetics. So it takes, just when you start shifting things around, you're going to see changes.
But I mean, also, is it because you're manipulating the physical?
Like, yes, absolutely.
So that's part, okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and if you breed white dogs, guess what you're going to get? So you're going to get deafness and blindness if you breed white dogs. So, if you breed for this kind of hip, then you're going to get something. The problem is they don't know what that something is. And they don't find that out until several generations down when people go, oh, wait a minute, these dogs are now so reactive that we can't even have them in the room together.
So what's the percentage of, is that sort of research done on the percentage of GSDs that have this common issue?
No, they don't, because an awful lot of German Shepherds are not registered. And an awful lot of breeders do not want to actually, they don't want to follow that path. Now, that's not true of other dogs, like the Giant, the Leonbergers. They are very, very careful about making sure that they're not getting fallout from their breeding. They could do other things, I suppose. But, okay, so here's another adolescent German Shepherd, just for the heck of it.
This is older. This one is about 14 months old. But you can see that... I mean, admittedly, my dog is really happy about it. So, can you see a little conflict? I want to play, but I'm scared. I want to play, but I'm scared.
excited. I think she would if she were given enough reason to.
They're always trying to pin the puppies down, even when they're puppies, they're trying to pin the other puppies down.
Yeah.
A lot of the shepherds and
get them controlled.
And put them down on the throat, not just.
Well, all play is practice for adulthood, and that's a kill bite, right? So that would be something that they would do. I think the thing that strikes me here is there, what we think of as a play bow is also a stalk. So remember that, okay? That whole behavior that looks like that, I remember at Wolf Park, it was just amazing. These wolves looked like they were play bowing, but they were not play bowing. They were stalking the buffalo. So that behavior, that stalking behavior, the dog can go in any direction except backwards very, very fast. So it is a position of power. So when they get into that, you have to decide whether or not this is a real play bow. And I do think this dog, by the way, was very conflicted about what she wanted. But do they want to fight or do they want to play? And it could be fighting. We don't see it all that often, but it definitely could be fighting.
Where's the kill bite?
You say the front or the back? Well, the predatory bite's here, right on the back. But anything on the neck is considered a kill bite, you know, if they're going for the neck.
And this is predatory, is it?
That's predatory. If they're going from the back, then the thing is that if a dog is bringing down big prey, they don't go for the back of the neck, they go for the hamstring, they go for the back of the legs. So they will bite through the hamstring, cripple the animal, and then go to the back of the head. So, but if a big dog goes for one of your little dogs, they're going to go for right around here because they don't need to hamstring them, and they can't reach their legs. You know, so, yeah.
So you said that with a 7-month-old that you could do pretty much whatever, and the dog is probably always going to be reactive to other dogs, so it's very difficult. So what if you had a German Shepherd that was fine and then got attacked and then was like, that was it, no more dogs, no more reactive dogs. And speaking of dog that I've talked to someone about, and this dog, it has about a 20-foot threshold, so it's not like crazy far, but you can't go any past that. Is that also like no behavior bind? You manage it. The owner manages it really well and lovely to people, but can you do behavior mod for something like that? Or is that it? You just manage.
Okay, so when you're talking about reactivity,
yeah.
And particularly with German Shepherds, but any dog, your choices, you have a lot of techniques that you can use, right? But your choices are fairly limited. You need to either change the emotion that the dog is feeling from fear, in this case, to love or just being happy. Or you need to change the behavior and inhibit the behavior. When you're doing training, that's where you figure out what you're doing. Am I just inhibiting this behavior and saying, no, you're not allowed to do this? Or am I trying to change the behavior and say that dogs are good? A lot of it has to do with where the dog is going to be, how amenable the dog is to your training, how amenable the dog is to your emotional level of commitment to the dog. And so there's a lot here that, you know, people think, well, I don't want the dog to do that. Well, we're thinking from our point of view. From their point of view, trying to change a dog's mind about something that actually, I mean, if you take one of those poor children who were in the school when it was shot up, you think they're ever going to be able to stand and look at a gun and not shake? You know, because this was horribly, horribly traumatic for them, and it's going to be carried through their lives. So in a case with a dog like that, you probably would want to work on inhibitions first, and then over a long period of time, you might be able to change the dog's emotions, but not necessarily with all other dogs. So we are limited in what we can do, because first of all, we're trying to change another entity. And if you try to change me, it would be very difficult for you to do that, for me to change you. So now this is another species, and we're trying to do that. So, you know, when you're using treats in training, you know, what you're trying to do usually is actually do accomplish both if you can. You're saying good things happen to dogs who are good when there's other dogs around at the same time that you should be following me. But like for that, for the dog, the Airedale, I'm pretty sure after walking with her yesterday that her behavior is like boom. So in this case, I'm going to be inhibiting her behavior. I'm going to say, I want you to do it. Now, that's not to say I'm not going to use treats. I am. But I'm going to, no, I don't want you to do that. Good, you're going to come over here. I'm not going to try to make her feel better. I'm going to try to make her just do what I want her to do. Because she's got a lot of confidence. She's near death, you know. So when you're raising German Shepherds, separating puppies from the guardians a lot to avoid separation issues. This would include having the other people come and take them to their house if you've got friends that would do that, or taking them to a doggy daycare that you trusted a lot, and you know, or something like that. But not having the dog be with that would be with the primary caretaker all the time. Some people I just saw. I guess I saw two people this week. Anyway, they have a new dog, and they said, "Oh, we haven't separated ourselves from the dog yet." And, oh, it's a golden retriever lab mix from, it's a change of career dog with some fear issues from CCI. And my first piece of advice was, the dog is very clingy, is you've got to leave. You have to leave for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but you have to start leaving now because otherwise she's going to expect you to always be there. Most of the consult was just trying to tell the female owner that the dog is really okay, that she'll be okay. She's just not a good assistance dog because she has too much of a fear response. So from my point of view, that makes her a lucky dog because she gets to be a pet, which is kind of a nice thing. Exposure to a lot of variety environments is really important. There are breeders who think that the fact that they take their dogs to dog shows, that that's a lot of environments, but in reality, that's the same environment over and over and over again. So a lot of different environments like shopping centers and places like that are really good because the dog can then observe what's going on. And teaching relaxation when the environment is noisy. I would say for every single puppy in the world, this would be good. Taking the puppy to where people are yelling and screaming and having a great time and teaching the dog to relax in that location. Can you imagine how nice that would be as the dog grew up and could actually relax when the world is falling apart? You know, that's just a really good piece of advice, no matter what. And then also doing obedience in tense situations where things are happening that nobody knows anything about. So that not only the owner, dog, but also the owner can go, okay, when I'm nervous and I say sit, you still sit even though I am nervous. Because remember, these dogs are attached to you with a psychic cord. And so anything that you do is going to play off of them and vice versa. German Shepherds, status-wise, I've never really had a lot of problems with German Shepherds, although I have had one or two in consults. They will often step into a vacancy at the top, and they will almost invariably make the wrong decision because, of course, they're dogs, and they're living in a human world. I always remember one of the worst cases I ever had was a client, husband, wife, daughter, son, who adopted two white German Shepherds, which is not a good idea to begin with, but they were siblings. One was supposed to be for one daughter, one was supposed to be for the son. And no, actually they didn't. They had just a one German Shepherd. This was the second one was two. They had one German Shepherd. She was a very nice dog, but they completely abdicated responsibility to the house, to the dog. The husband was a pilot. He was gone most of the time, and when he came back, he would yell and scream at the dog, and he actually physically abused the dog. And I think he physically abused the wife and daughter as well. And the dog, because the husband was beating the family, or he started beating, the dog started beating the people. So he would bite both women in the house for doing anything. So the German Shepherd definitely thought that she had, there was status, she had the status in the household. So I got really upset during the consult, and because the guy said, I just want the dog to behave. And I said, don't you care about your wife and your daughter? They're getting bitten by this dog. I mean, the wife couldn't move her pinky finger at all because the dog had bitten through right here. And the daughter had this great big bite right here. And I said, this dog has to be put to sleep because you can't, what you've done to this dog. And they finally decided to do it. They surrendered the dog and euthanized the dog. And then they proceeded to go get two white German Shepherds, which I saw like a year later in consult for exactly the same problems. because they hadn't changed themselves at all. You know, it was just really sad. So I'm going to go into a little bit of behavior mod here, which I don't know if I really have enough time to do this, but for territorial aggression, permanent management of environment, controlling space through management and training. For fear-based aggression, relationship adjustment, trust in the owner. Threshold work, which is desensitization and counter-conditioning, and lots and lots and lots of obedience. And for German Shepherds in particular, abandonment training is a really good thing to try if you have the wherewithal to do it. German Shepherds are so attached to their owners that when the owner runs away, the dog wants to follow. So it's a really nice beginning level training to tell the dog what you want, because most of the time when you have reactive dogs, what happens is the dog starts to bark and lunge, right? And then the owner pulls back on the leash. You can't let go. How can you let go? You know, because the dog had to go bounding at the other dog. And so what happens then is that it's a spiral. It just keeps going and going and going and going. So with abandonment training, you have a trainer who has a long line, and the owner lets go of the leash and leaves. And most German Shepherds particularly will just turn around and follow them. Like, oops, I didn't know you were leaving, I'm gonna come. So here's a little video of something like, this was years ago, with when my hair was long.
Hard to get all of them in there.
He's focusing on the other dog when I say it's go now. But with a lot of dogs, it was hard for him. I missed that about the shelter. Okay, everybody with the dog. We're going to work on this dog now.
You know, we don't have any good staff dogs anymore.
Oh, that's a shame, because we had tons of them.
I know.
Yeah.
We're having problems with that.
Yeah. Well, you have to actually kind of choose your dogs for their ability to get along with other dogs. That's how that kind of works. German Shepherds are really hard to be in a shelter. Anybody who works in a shelter, you know this. They make a lot of noise. They're really difficult to deal with. They're easily aroused by other kennel dogs. So rescue is generally your best case scenario. They need lots of consistent training. They need a consistent handler. They need all kinds of consistencies that some dogs like terriers couldn't care less about. So I'm only going to play a tiny little bit of this because it's very noisy. Typical German Shepherd. Walk through a kennel and they're like, ah, God, that's so much fun. Now, you can turn it off now. There. Okay. All right. So there are German Shepherds and to a certain extent Malinois. Any questions about them before we go to bullies? This is a big one on bullies. This is long because we have so many pit bulls. Anybody? Nope. Okay. So bullies, for our purposes, bullies are a lot of different breeds. There's the American Pit Bull Terrier, which you know people always call all bullies pit bulls. There's Amstaffs, American Staffordshire Terriers. Staffordshire Bull Terriers. Boxers, I put in this group too because they have the same kind of behaviors. At Dog Day Bordeaux, which you don't see very much, and they only live about 6 years anyway.
Are they like a French Mastiff?
They're a French Mastiff, yeah. They usually keel over between 6 and 7. Yes, it's ridiculous. And Warbles. Warbles are getting more popular.
What is that?
Just Mastiffy. They're South African?
Yeah, they're a South African breed. They're very, very large.
About 160 pounds.
Yeah. They're absolutely enormous. I have a former student who actually has two Borbles, and anytime I get a recommendation for a Borble trainer, I send them to him. Because I am no longer able to, if I ever was, able to handle them. And he's a really good trainer. So they are exactly, they're Mastiffy. So they have a high degree of territoriality. They're extremely protective. And they're not generally friendly to other dogs. And one of the interesting things about a Borble is that, and for that matter, all the bullies, is that the people who first bred them were, you know, remember I was talking about form follows function, right? Yeah. So the people who were first breeding for them were not breeding for dog friendliness. They lived in South Africa on large estates, and these animals protected against things like lions and hyenas and possibly other dogs. So being friendly to other dogs had nothing, there was nothing about their temperament that would have indicated that. And yet here we are with these dogs that were meant to do something completely different, and we expect them to be in a dog park. Our expectations exceed our intelligence in a lot of cases. So they're, most of what we consider bullies are medium to large. Their origins in two totally different breed types, we think. The first are the Molossers and the second are the Terriers. The Molossers are the big, heavy-headed dogs like these guys. I don't know why it's jumping up and down. This Mastiff here, and of course we all know what Terriers are. So if you were going to breed a Molosser to a Terrier, it would probably be a fairly large Terrier. What you would try to get is the tendencies from each of these different kinds of breeds. So you get strength and size from Molossers and tenacity, speed, and ferocity from Terriers. So strength and size. Some of the Molossers would be like the Dog de Bordeaux is one of them. What's the ones that are really, really popular here?
Frenchies.
Hmm?
Oh, you're talking about Bull Masters.
Well, they're somewhat popular, but the ones you see all over the place, Berners.
Oh.
Bernese Mountain Dogs. They're a Molosser. So are the St. Bernards. You can tell they've got those really, really wide heads, and usually their ears are drop ears or they're almost always drop ears. And they've got the short muzzles. So they're actually neotenized. You know, which we talked about in some, they're very much, they do not have a lot of the behavior patterns of other dogs. So for instance, German Shepherds have eye stalk. So if a German Shepherd sees something, they'll go eye stalk chase really fast, but they still do the eye stalk. So it gives you a kind of a nanosecond of warning. Molossers don't. They don't have that whole, because they're neotenized, they don't have that whole pattern of behavior. So they can go from, and this is one of the reasons why if you're bitten by a Molosser, it's even more, well, instantaneous than it is with a, I can usually tell if a German Shepherd's thinking about biting me. But I can't always tell if a Mastiff is going to bite me. And in fact, it is a really big surprise. Actually, what you just talked about happened with a Mastiff that was, luckily I had him on a tie down. But I was kind of working on sitting down, and I had him do a down, and I didn't give him a treat after the second one, and he went to bite me so fast. And again, the only reason I still have a hand is because he hit the end of the tether. That was it. On the other hand, a German Shepherd, come to think of it now that my brain is working, she actually tore the eye bolt out of the wall to get to me. And the only reason she didn't bite me is because the owner had wrapped the leash. He was so nervous. He'd wrapped his leash around his arm about 40 times.
Okay.
He had a long line on the dog. And so when the dog went for me, it pulled him over, and it effectively stopped her from getting me. And then he goes, "What should I do about this?" And I'm like, "Take the dog back." He got it from San Francisco SPCA. This was years ago. But he did not take the dog back. Yeah?
Now, is it Newfoundland in that case?
Yes. Yes,
oh, okay.
Yes. So any of those big lumbering dogs, they come from the mountains, and I was going to say the Appalachians, but that's not the right one, the Alps. And so they're big, they're heavy boned, they carry a heavy coat to them. And so those are the original molossers.
So are you saying they don't give warnings when they bite?
They do not give warning when they bite. They just bite. They bite first, think about it later. And that's, again, that's because the eye stalk doesn't exist in them. So they trace their roots back to the mastiff-type dogs originated in Greece and Albania. And they made their way through the rest of mainland Europe after that. The breeds are characterized by, again, a large head with foreshortened muzzle, extremely strong jaws, heavy bone, and thick skin. So the molossers include Tibetan Mastiff. Anybody seen a Tibetan Mastiff?
Yes.
They are pretty freaking scary dogs.
He brought two over from Bhutan.
He brought them from Tibet?
Bhutan, yeah. Like, they're the same area. It's an adventure travel company, so he brought them both back.
Wow.
They were totally dogs. I mean, they were mountain dogs.
They were nice dogs?
Oh, really nice.
Because I have met like three that are not nice dogs. And one of them, the owner lived in Sonoma, and they'd gotten these Tibetan Mastiffs because they had a bunch of chickens and other small animals on their farm, and they have coyotes. And so the Tibetan Mastiffs would go around the farm and make sure that the coyotes didn't get them. But that meant that the Mastiffs also protected the property against anybody else. And I found them to be terrifying because they are so big. They're like 200 pounds.
These guys weren't that big. These guys were probably like 100 and 10.
No, these guys are...
They're
also,
they're being bred. Nobody cares what they look like in Utah.
Yeah, right? They kind of look like lions. They're just absolutely enormous. A dog de Bordeaux, Mastiff, Newfoundland, all the flock guards are molossers. So all the white flock guards,
Great Pyrenees,
Cuvaz, all those. So, and then there are some smaller molossers, which include the American Pit Bull Terrier, the American Bulldog, the Rottweiler, and the Boxer. And then, of course, there's terriers that are the smaller ones that are the same kind of dogs, and that would be pugs, French Bulldog, and Boston Terriers. Just think about their heads. So they just got bred down and down and down and down and down and down and down. So you could think of a pug as being a mastiff on a very small scale.
But they don't feel small.
They don't what?
They don't feel small.
They don't feel small?
They think they're big.
Yeah.
Oh.
Mine is.
I don't know. I've always wondered, because I've had people say, my dog thinks it's a person. And I go, no, they think you're a dog. So I'm not sure that they think they're small. They just think that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they look up. Because for Flocka, for our Chihuahua, being small is a really big deal. Because being small means she's very vulnerable. But for your pug,
yeah.
It doesn't matter.
That's a terrier, right?
Yeah.
A terrier, you couldn't care less if the dog is too.
No, they're just not. Right? Yeah, well, these are terriers or animals that go for, that hunt animals larger than themselves. So you have to remember that when you're thinking about getting a terrier. So molossers do not use eye stalk behavior at all. They appear to be neontinized and the behavior does not develop. Instead, the dog will tend to go from seeing to acting in the blink of an eye. So when he is angry, when a molosser is angry, and this includes a Rottweiler as well, although I'm going to go into that again in the protective breeds, the precursors can be so quick that you don't see them. So for instance, a dog that might be thinking about biting you, if it's a Rottweiler or another molosser, you actually will get the eyebrows will go in, or the ears will just go a little tiny bit up, but you're not going to see very much more than that. It is really, really hard to read them. You cannot see what they're thinking about. And when you're in a shelter and you're trying to figure out if this is a nice dog or not a nice dog, and you know, you don't have a wagging tail to go by, because a lot of them have docked tails, and you know, and they're just looking at you, and they look at you like this.
What about the hair on their back?
Doesn't go up.
It doesn't.
No, they don't worry about that, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it certainly does when they really get aroused, but if they're still in the decision-making process, it does not seem to go up as a precursor. So, I mean, they can be really nice dogs. I had two Rotties, they were wonderful dogs, but I never, ever could predict what they were thinking. I can tell what all of our dogs are thinking now, Heather never thinks about anything. but you know, if you think about your dogs, you can usually kind of get an idea of what they're thinking about, right? But you couldn't with Joe Bear. Joe Bear, I would have him on the ground and I'd be petting him and he'd start to growl. And I knew it was just a grumble, kind of a purr, because he didn't bite me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's a really good... Yeah.
Just hang around to find out.
Yeah, I didn't find out. You know, so what I would do is what I do with it, what you do with a cat, right? I'd pet him twice, he'd grumble, and I'd stop, and he'd go, no, some more. And so I'd pet him twice, some more, and then he'd grumble. And then so I figured out after a while that that grumble was actually a happy grumble, but it took a long time because I didn't trust him. I mean, I couldn't read him. I couldn't read him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we're doing dog to dog and it's a bully, does the other dog know how to read the bully?
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, this is the biggest issue. This is one of the biggest issues with the bullies, is that they read each other pretty well. But they do not read other dogs well, and the other dogs don't read them very well. So it's as though they are French and Japanese, right? They just don't have, there's not even some syntax in common. So it's very difficult for dogs to read bully dogs, and very difficult for bullies to read other dogs. And, you know, you'll see the bullies go crashing into another dog, and then they go, "Boy, that was fun, didn't I have a good time?" And the other dog's going, "No! I didn't," but it was, you know, it just felt like that to the bully dog. So an awful lot of the problems that we have with pit bulls have to do with miscommunication. It's not really aggression, what we think of as aggression, it's just miscommunication.
So how do you do the dog to dog? What would you suggest?
With a dog to dog with a bully?
Yeah.
And another kind of dog?
Bully, and we've got another shelter dog, and we're testing them, and it always feels like such a crapshoot.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm talking about bullies, I may as well. So this is a good way to do it, but it's hard. If you play with a bully for a little bit and try to get him calm, so just play low-level games with him, and then see if you can hug him, okay? So you actually have to go through part of the evaluation. And if you hug him, you kind of hang on like this. And what you're going to do is bring the other dog in while you're holding on to him. Yeah, I know. This is really scary. You don't necessarily have them really come up to each other. You have you're trying. This is all a Trish stuff. Okay, this is just because this is how it worked for me, and it works with Luke, and it's worked with other dogs, with other pitties. I mean, not the huge ones. And you have to trust your dog. You have to trust the dog you're hugging the dog. He's not going to bite you. And then you bring the other dog in, and you're trying to actually contain this dog's energy because they have this explosive energy. So you're containing it. You're holding it and holding it and holding it. And then when you bring the other dog up, you have to have the other dog facing away. So then you have the other dog like this with the other person so that there's a sniff to butt. Then you give everybody a little bit of a rest. Then you do it again. And usually by the third time, they're better. You're okay. The other way you can do it, which is easier, is to have the dog on a leash behind a fence, bring the other dog up to the fence. Mm-hmm. But if you have the dog on a leash, remember that thing I was talking about with the turn and face? For those of you who are at the classwork. So you're actually holding the dog's collar down, and you're not doing it with a face. When you do turn and face, they're facing you. In this case, they're facing away. You hold, and you do this, but with a fence in between. And you're actually, again, trying to hold that energy in. Does it always work? No.
So you're trying to see if they're going to break. I mean, are you evaluating the dog?
Well, what we want to do is, this is evaluation. What we want to do is figure out whether or not the dog is friendly. And their body language is so bad that a lot of times the other dog will respond poorly to them.
So
if you can have the dog meet before. And it's one of the things I've always said, dogs should never meet for the first time. Right?
You throw that first one away.
Yeah. Throw that first one away. And then the other thing is they should never go on the first half of their walk.
Yeah.
Oh.
So if you just only have second half of the walks and only have the dog meeting, so then if you have time to bring the dog, you know, take the dogs away and bring it back again. Really, having them meet several times without actually engaging with that real high level engagement is a good thing. Now, when you're doing evaluations, you don't have that time. You just don't have that time.
And they're trying to get our evals shorter now. They just told us that we have to start tracking I mean, some of the evaluators take way too long, and I think it's partly because of her, but they're trying to make them shorter now.
Oh, we tried to do that forever. A good evaluation can take a couple hours.
So last question, do you ever think the fence makes that worse? Because we do that with the fences.
Fences can make it worse, but they can also make it better if you've got the dog on a leash. If you give the fence, you know, they're running back and forth in the fence, and they're getting a charge out of that, right? So if you have them on a leash and they can't do that, but they can go up and meet each other through the fence, and they can't bite each other.
Yeah.
You know? Now, I know at Oakland, what they do is just kind of go, 1, 2, 3, let them go.
Seriously?
In a lot of cases, yeah. They might do in fact, that's what Trisha's doing right now. She's at Oakland, and they're doing meet and greets right now at Oakland. And because they have so many pit bulls that they take more chances there, they have to. And you know, most of the time it works out well. But if you have two pitties meet each other, it's much better than a pit bull and a German Shepherd or a pit bull and a herding dog, because they just don't communicate well. Again, I don't know which one's Japanese and which one is French, but, you know, they don't communicate well. But, I mean, if you look at that dog, that, you know, what that dog is grabbing hold of a branch, right?
Yeah.
It's actually being held with a branch. You can see what the power of the molosser head is. That jaw grabs and holds on. If you think about what a German Shepherd does or a Heeler does or any of the other herding dogs, they slash and run. They're always in and out. These dogs are not bred for that. These dogs are bred for hang on, hold on. And so if you get into a problem, it's very difficult to stop the problem from occurring.
So that's why they always say, oh, they have a lockjaw.
It's just that they're so strong.
Yeah.
Years ago at the museum in San Francisco, they had a whole thing on dog skulls. It was so interesting. And the amazing thing was in the back of the American Pit Bull Terrier's head, right back here, the tendons of the holes for the tendons were like that big. And in every other breed, they were like about that big. Just that phenomenal amount of muscle that they have in their jaw to hold the jaw closed.
In Oakland, when they're doing these intros and sometimes it's going to go bad, how do they separate and not get hurt, the people not get hurt? Like, do they have a hose?
They have hoses and stuff like that. I think that most of the time they've done a preliminary evaluation. The dog has come out kind of okay. And so this is and should be the last part of their eval, right? I mean, we used to occasionally do dog before we did the rest of it, but the problem is, and then you don't know whether the dog redirects. It's really good to know whether a dog redirects before you have them do a dog intro. So when we do evaluations, we'll talk a little bit more about that. So terriers, we're still talking about bullies here, but if you think about what the terrier part of this would be, the dog is hardy, prey-driven, fearless. Terriers will go after anything. They attack to kill. They are the only killers left. Terriers. Yes, they actually will kill. And most are very small to medium size. So you get these two together and you get this amazing amount of tenaciousness in the dog. So when you combine breed types like this, you get a frontal presentation in challenge. So all the molossers, when they come to greet you, they go, "Hi, how are you?" Right? They're not like sideways like the way the herders mean.
Okay.
It's kind of going to be around like this, just a little bit more around. And for the pitties and the other and boxers and other molossers, it's a frontal presentation. This is totally normal for this breed. You just have to be, you have to be aware of that when you're having the dogs meet each other. They make their decisions very quickly because they are terrier types. They often lack precursors to behavior. So again, that's molossers. And they have different fighting styles from all the other breeds where they do the bite and hold rather than slash and run. So the biggest issue that we have for our bullies in our area is the fact that many of them are dog aggressive. Many, many, many of them. You know, I've heard it as high as maybe 65% to 70%, which is pretty darn high. So, you know, the reason they are like that is because, guess what? We bred for it. Human beings bred for this, and we are reaping what we sow. So, pit bull terriers in particular were bred to fight other dogs in pits. The human beings would bet on the outcome so the dog could handle the most damage, was the most valued. They were bred to be people friendly. You could go into a pit, grab hold of two dogs, separate them, and people would not be hurt at all. This, over the last 20, 25 years, has gone away. Now we have more pit bull terriers that are actually people aggressive as well as dog aggressive, although their people aggression tends to be fear-based.
I had an unfortunate occasion to meet a fighting pit bull, you know, and be around some of the people, and I didn't know. I had a girlfriend that called up and said, "Hey, I'm here, come visit." And she didn't tell me where here was until we got there. And she showed me a horn, a short horn, and that's what they would use to jab in behind.
It's a break stick.
Yeah.
It's a break stick.
And they jab it into their jaw.
Yeah, they actually put it in like this and they twist.
Twisted so it'd go.
I have one client who has a pit bull and she carries one with her all the time. She's never had the dog fight anybody, but she's ready.
To make sure.
Yeah.
She's ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was so terrifying.
I bet it was. Ugh.
And this dog roamed around the house. I was just, he sensed it. He chose me. We spent the night and he chose me to body up to. And I was just, shit. I'm not getting out of this.
He wanted you to like him a lot.
Yeah. Do I roll off onto the floor?
So why do you think they've become more human aggressive? I mean,
because they have stopped breeding for people friendliness. What happens when you stop breeding for something? It goes away. You know? So besides, there are people who actually like the idea that their dogs are aggressive to people. So they would encourage that. This is not okay, but that's what, I mean, there are a lot of really horrible people in the world. We should be, you know, talking about the people, not the dogs most of the time. But these dogs had to be very friendly. If a dog was not friendly, they were euthanized immediately. So because they had to trust them in the pit. They had to trust them. English Bull Terriers were also used to fight at the dogs, but not particularly popular here. It's actually kind of interesting from the point of view of the fighting people. The pit bull terriers and English bull terriers, what they wanted was a very sleek dog, highly, highly muscled, very difficult for another dog to actually grab hold of. So their eyes are also back far in their head, particularly the bull terriers, if you think about where their eyes are. And then they crop their ears because the ears bleed a lot. So if you crop their ears when they're puppies, then it's very hard for another dog to catch hold of an ear, and then for the blood to get in their eyes. So it is that's the reason they're cropped. English Bull Terriers were pulled out of that whole thing. People stopped using them for fighting quite some time ago. They are still odd dogs. They've got high degrees of OCD behaviors. They are often somewhat aggressive. I don't think they can see very well at all. You just don't see that many of them. Interestingly enough, the mini bull terriers are usually nicer. Now, I know I've got some video of a not nice mini bull terrier, but a lot of them are really nice, actually. Then English bulldogs were used for bull baiting, and bull baiting was an English sport. It's never took on here, thank goodness, but it was... It started off being something where the bulldogs would hold on to the nose of a bull while they castrated it. So, you know, gave the bull something to think about. And so the bulldog would hold the nose of the bull down and they would castrate the bull and then they'd let it go. And that's the reason that the jaw of the English bulldog is out above the nose so that they could still breathe while they were holding on to the nose. Now, if you looked at when they did this back in the early 1900s and before, English bulldogs did not look like they do now. So if you tried to have an English bulldog do that now, they would die immediately. So they couldn't do it. English bulldogs and Sharpeys and some of the other fighting dogs have loose skin because that doesn't give them much to hang on to. It gives them nothing vital to hang on to. So it's a different kind of way of looking at fighting. So what happens when you're breeding for fighting dogs? Some of the things that we see as common problems in our bullies. Quick to arouse, whether through play or excitement. So if you've got puppy, bull, you know, English bulldogs or pit bulls or whatever playing with each other, they can go over the top pretty quickly because they're bred to be quickly aroused. So of course, one of the things that we work on in perpetuity with these dogs is calming them down. So because we want them to calm down, and it's very difficult. They get that keening noise, you know, when they get really, really aroused and they cannot stop themselves. And my personal feeling is they are not in their right mind at all. So they're not with us mentally in the slightest. Very difficult to calm down. A very quick temper. So if they get hurt in play, it can turn into aggression really quickly. Very focused on what they're doing. Physically tough and resilient. There was a case several years ago in Sausalito where a pit bull mix attacked a father and daughter. And the father threw the daughter on top of a car, and then he clambered up there himself, and the pity just kept on going for them. Actually took out all four tires of the car, which is pretty amazing. The police came and they shot the dog four times, and it didn't die. And they finally got it to the Humane Society, and I think it died like 6 hours later. Is that amazing or what? You know, that amount of resiliency is phenomenal. We couldn't believe it. None of us could believe it.
Well, they have a hard time shutting it off. Like, they can't shut it off. I see that in the bully that I watch.
No, they can't. That's what they're hard to calm down. Yeah. Once they get going, they get the adrenaline in their system. And I understand that this is the same thing that happens when people get into a fight. It's just that instinct takes over, and you just really start to go. And then eventually, when you start to calm down, you start to shake because all the adrenaline is leaving your body. So if you can imagine that if you were bred to do that, you know, and so that's why you do it over and over and over again. This is one of the reasons why these dogs are like this.
And they can't hear you.
They can't hear you. Any dog in arousal can't hear you. I always think they're hearing something like, something so far away as to have no effect on them whatsoever. They have a very strong predatory instinct. I remember talking to somebody who was an aficionado of pit bulls a long time ago, and they said, oh no, they don't have any predatory instinct. And they have a huge predatory instinct. That doesn't mean to say that you can't raise them with cats, and they can be great with cats. They can be, you know, if they're any dog raised with other kinds of animals can be great with those kinds of animals, as long as they're inside or in the environment in which they normally see them. So they don't usually use stalking behaviors. But they can, you know, they're available to them. What I've noticed, and I think what a few other trainers have noticed, is that a lot of these dogs are just really happy-go-lucky, sweet little things until they're about over 9 months old, at which time they get physically and mentally intolerant. So at that point, then they might turn and become aggressive, not towards people again, the good ones, although occasionally that does happen. And the other thing that's unusual about the bullies is that the cross-gender fighting is very common. If you are going to raise fighting dogs, you shouldn't only have males to males and females to females. So you will see cross-gender fighting. They will fight with the other sex. It does not occur very often in other breeds. It does occur, it's just not very often. Having said all that, every dog needs to be evaluated on its own merits. It's really important to do that. And there are some absolutely stupendous bully dogs, just like there are stupendous German Shepherds and stupendous everything else. And so, all that you're doing is carrying around the knowledge of why a dog might be this way. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to color your decision as to whether or not to pass this dog for adoption or to take this dog or to have a client take a dog or whatever. So there is no breed that produces the same behavior across the board. And they are all dog. It's just good to know all this stuff. And besides that, in my opinion, it's fascinating. So I don't know. I think I'm going to skip the puppies. Don't skip the... Okay. So it's always mom with puppies. Do you want me to quickly do puppies here? Okay, so some puppies show problem behaviors from the very beginning. Most puppies do not. And you really worry if puppies show problem behaviors from the beginning. As we know, you really worry that. Okay.
Did she do that or did she just slip?
Wait a second. This is a very interesting puppy. This was up at Sonoma Healing. So this is an adult healer playing with a pit bull puppy. And Sue was worried because she thought the pity puppy was showing some behaviors that she did not think were going to be good for a family. And so we were doing some play behaviors. And as you'll be able to see, this puppy is very appropriate with the healer, but she's not exactly appropriate with dogs that were smaller than her. So this is kind of, this is pretty common in some of these dogs. So she's about 10 weeks old.
Maggie, you're some dog.
Look at her wiggle. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I think I'll just turn over here. You are very large. Now with a puppy.
Why don't you put that one over here? Look at that.
Oh, yeah. Let's see.
So she's lost all that.
How do I zoom on this
going over the top.
Isn't that ugly? Yeah.
Going to the back of the neck.
That's what I was seeing. Now it all is coming back.
Right over the top.
Yep. Yeah, there's no relationship at all.
Didn't tend to bond with people.
Do you think any of that was enhanced because of being on the leash?
No, not with a puppy. No, I think if they had taken her off the leash, she would have really gone to town on the young and the little one. So yeah, that wouldn't be okay. I mean, size matters, and this girl, a little pit puppy, she felt big and powerful. And she also, I think there's that, remember we talked about the fixed action patterns? So they start to get up on top like that, and then they just continue with the behavior. So it's as though that they intentionally start the behavior, but instinct finishes it for them.
Okay.
I don't know. I know my recommendation was not to put her up for adoption. But I think they
so
probably
that
euthanize
did.
Hmm?
Is not for adoption to euthanize?
That's what that means, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not at all shelters, though. Sometimes it means move it to the rescue.
Yeah.
It's just moving the responsibility somewhere.
From one place to another.
Yeah, so that it shifts your numbers.
And, you know, there are shelters that take all their problem dogs and ship them to Idaho, as though Idaho has a better grasp on how to work with these problem animals.
It might be a farm. It could be a ranch.
Oh, well, the ranches and farms all got used up. There's no more ranches and farms. Well, you've got a new ranch and farm over there.
Yeah. No.
So here's another one. This is a puppy with Aspen, and Aspen is going to try to tell him off, but it's not going to work very well. She's pretty bright that way. But so what do you think that puppy would do with her?
Just overwhelm her.
And I think he would treat her like a squeaky toy.
Yeah.
I don't think the dog is malicious at all, but it's a problem behavior. And that dog definitely went up for adoption. But then you try to tell the people who are adopting this dog, you need to watch out. And they go, but it's just a puppy. It's made out of clay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where I have the problems, because people tend to think that dogs are made out of clay, and even a lot of trainers think dogs are made out of clay, and they're so not. So it's just something that needs to be.
So you got this dog out, and what are like the top things you say to this owner? Let's say the owner is fairly like, I don't think the dog is clay, but what, I really love this dog. What do I do? What are the best things I can do for this dog?
Don't take the dog to a dog park.
Right. Okay. So don't take him to the dog park.
Don't take him to puppy class.
Okay.
Not puppy class where they're going to play. Have him play with dogs that are big. And old adult dogs who will put him in his place when he needs to be put in his place, but will engage with him. Almost all pushy puppies should play with adult dogs. Our current practice of having puppies play with other puppies is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't teach them anything. It just teaches them to have a good time with other puppies. It doesn't teach them how to be polite. That has to happen with adult dogs.
If Aspen would have been left alone with that dog unsupervised, how far would it go?
Oh, I think he would probably just start to, you know, rip into her because she's a toy. She's little.
Would she kill her?
That dog, no. I don't. That dog had puppy teeth.
Okay.
But you know, another dog might, in complete innocence, it might. Just because, as far as it's concerned, it's a toy. You know, it's this nice squeaky toy. These are predators. They're meant to kill things. So that doesn't actually, they're not going to say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. That's not part of what they do. So choosing a puppy is really important. Tolerant and friendly to humans and dogs. Somewhat submissive is really good, but not fearful. It's hard to tell the difference. But you could in that first puppy when she just kept flipping over for the big dog. Was she afraid? No, she's just kind of going, oh, like me, really, like me. And that's really good. And you look for resilience. So, and I put this in here a long time ago, but shelters have a responsibility to vet puppies as much as they do adults, looking for aberrant behavior, rare but there, something that needs to be looked at. Adolescence puppy behavior matures and tolerance can become worse. You can't know exactly when. With Luke, who's a pit mix with some other breeds in there, it was at 9 months, but for some it's a year and a half. So it really depends on the dog. A good percentage of bully dogs show social maturity around inappropriate behavior around social maturity.
You're saying intolerance, you just like it's different than reactivity, you're just like, God. And or they go after, like, how do you?
Well, it's like they're playing and they suddenly lose their temper.
I see.
Everything is fine, and then suddenly they go, blah, 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 you know, and then they've lost their temper.
Okay.
So they're showing intolerance. And if they're a certain kind of dog, when they show that intolerance, they don't stop at just kind of going, don't do that.
Okay.
They keep going. So with Luke, he was playing with a bunch of other dogs in a yard. He was chasing the ball, bringing it back, chasing the ball, bringing it back. Somebody brought a poodle in. The poodle was chasing a ball, bringing it back. Luke turned and went for the poodle. Took it down. And I'm like, whoa, what just happened? And so we tried again, and he went for again. This time we had him on a long line. And subsequent to that, he went for like two or three other dogs. He never got one, except for the poodle. He took the poodle down. But it was between 9 and 10 months sometime. It was just a complete shock to us. He was always the best dog in the world. He was the most obedient. He was a really good dog. He did not have any kind of trauma. It just happened.
Do you think the ball had anything to do with that?
No. I think the arousal could have. He was chasing the ball and having a good time bringing it back, but he had done that every day. That's one of the ways that but he'd always had a tremendous amount of energy that he couldn't expend properly. So when we'd go for walks, he would start doing zoomies around, like going crazy. You know how the puppy rushes, how they do that? His puppy rushes lasted a long time. So he obviously had a great deal of, it's like he had a fire inside. And I think that was what it was. So there was arousal.
So is it better to take a zen approach to that energy or give it a release and let it out?
That's a really good question. I think in some way it has to be let out. I think it can be let out in ways that are a little bit different than what we might think about leaving it. You know, you could have your dog work, do a lot of find-its for toys or treats or things like that, to actually have them focus as opposed to just expending that big muscle energy. I did have a couple of clients, particularly when I was working in the South Bay, who had treadmills for their dogs, which could actually work that exercise through. So they would just do a treadmill, and then they would take them for a walk after the treadmill. So
you build a really in shape dog that needs that much every day.
Well, that's the problem, is that the more in shape they are, the more in shape they need to be. But at the same time, with the treadmill, you're not running, you're walking. You know, it's not a fast treadmill, it's a slow one. Underwater work is also the same thing. If you have a problem dog and you want to meet another dog, one of the best places to have them meet is in a swimming pool. They can't get to each other, and they're using all that energy to try to keep above, you know, keep their heads above water. We discovered this by accident in the ocean with one of the dogs I was working with. And he did much better. He didn't even have to be swimming. If you put him in, so he was up to about here, and he did much better because he had, everything was slow motion, right? Kind of interesting. This is another video. This is a typical vertical. So we got some high level.
Okay, now just let her go. Let her go.
This is just how very persistent they are, even when being pulled off. Everybody was scared of her. People were scared of her, other dogs were scared of her. His puppy was not scared of her.
She's not exactly worried, is she?
No. I liked that dog, by the way. Okay, so I do want to say this is play style, and this is something from Oakland. That's the bullying. Oh, tug of war! Don't play tug of war with your bully. This is what happens. They get really, really intense.
Violet won again.
And they can actually start fighting after tug of war. We never play tug with Luke.
Our pug had a seizure during tug-of-war.
Pardon?
Our pug, his puppy, was playing tug-of-war with Jack Russell. He had a seizure because
he got so aroused. They get so over-aroused. So now this is one of the things that people, this is a shelter thing, where dogs start to play tug with people. This is why I say don't play tug of war with these kinds of dogs. Unless you can teach a really good out where they drop it instantaneously, but you can't do that with shelter dogs. It's very difficult to teach a shelter dog. You don't have the time or inclination to do that, the time or the ability to do that. So, and there was one other one I really wanted to show, and then we'll take a break. This is, the bullies take such a long time. They deserve their own, you know, module. So I'm sorry that I'm kind of having to work through this, but many, many bullies have a tendency to stare. It's as though they're trying to take somebody on. I think, it's a behavior that has been bred into them. It is not their fault. They didn't do all this stuff. You have to bear in mind, none of this stuff is the dog's fault. This is all things that people have done to dogs. I am not against pit bulls. I like them. I just think that if we made a concerted effort to have them only be owned by middle-aged women, everything would be much better.
That's so true.
You know? So anyway, so you get this kind of challenging stare that these dogs have. So this is a pit that I was actually doing evaluation on for a client and watching his behavior with Strider.
Strider will have
and scary.
Yeah, and you
Strider means one, two, three.
That's gonna be a night.
Strider's going, la di da la di da.
Who's holding the pit bull yet?
I think that one of my assistants, not the owner. But they really, and the dog had some very nice things that about it, then, but they wanted to find out whether it was a good dog to own. So then we had Suzanne Gollin run her little dog on the outside of the fence, and the dog went, boom, total prey drive. So they said, maybe we won't take this dog, because they had a cat at home. Okay, so another body language thing to watch out for the bullies is pin and cover. Some of you may have already seen this behavior.
Is it Ridgeback bully?
No.
That's a Ridgeback.
Now what have you done? Okay, so come on.
It's a boxer, right?
This is a boxer. The guy was only mildly worried about it. He did it in the dog fight a few times. But he thought it was a play move. Do you think it's a play move?
No.
To me, this is not a play move.
Don't take this dog to the dog.
My recommendation was to stop taking the dog to the dog park. As far as I know, he went back to the dog park. But that's pretty dramatic, right?
I had a dog do that to one of my dogs, and I kicked the dog.
You what? Well, I mean, it's very difficult to not do something.
And it was a reaction, and the owner just came and wooed on me.
Yeah.
But the dog got off of my dog.
Sometimes they don't.
And I snagged him up really quick, and then the owner tried to, get down on me, and I said, I'm sorry, but you weren't doing anything.
Most of the time when dogs have a problem, people, especially the owners of the dogs, are so taken aback, they almost freeze in place. It's just they're so startled, they don't know what to do. I can't tell you how many people I've had as clients where they say, the owner of the dog just didn't do anything, but the owner of the dog is like totally and complete, like, ah! And so it's usually up to you to take action. As if you're still thinking, you're the one that has to take action, because people have different responses to stress, and some people freeze, and some people take action. Yeah.
Well, that's what happened when you came to our house for Buster, and both John and I were like, we had never seen anything like that. And all I was thinking, but I couldn't.
You can't act.
I couldn't move my body. It was all slow mo, and I was like.
And you see, I could have been dead meat there.
Okay. Well, I know.
Yeah.
So what are your options in the case of the boxer hovering over your animal?
I would have probably done the same thing.
I mean, does kicking...
Well, the best thing to do, usually, if you've got the presence of mind to do it, because it's quick, is you grab hold of the dog's collar and twist, and that cuts the dog's airway off, and they start gagging immediately, and they open their mouth.
Mm-hmm. So they could turn and get you.
It's hard to do that when you're holding on the thing, but yeah. And what people say to do is grab hold of the back legs, but the problem is that then they rip the skin if they're being torn off. So this opening the dog's mouth is usually the best thing to do, and that is the best way to do it. But other than that, I think, kicking the dog is a viable alternative.
That's also another reason why people should use prong collars.
Oh my God, yes.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, was there something else over here? Okay. So, in most cases, with most dogs like the boxer here or a lot of other dogs, there is no emotion. These dogs are not angry. they're actually acting out a very, very deep instinct. So that's why I think it's really more related to the prey instinct, to the predatory instinct, than it is to anger. That, I mean, did you think that the boxer was angry, or was he just responding?
Dominant.
Yeah, he's just responding. So it's an instinct that is not an emotion. So trying to tell the dog that don't feel bad about it is not going to do anything at all, because the dog doesn't feel bad to begin with.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, so the so that's why you have to contain and control dogs like this. This is really important. With Lukey Poo, I mean, we call him Lukey Poo because he's a nice little dog now, but I mean, you know, we had to keep him away from other dogs. And he learned that other dogs can go by him and he has to be good and all that kind of stuff, because if he got too close, his instincts would take over. And it's not anger. It's instinct. Make sense? Okay.
They know, you know, if they're in an arousal state, they know when to stop. And I was really impressed when I saw that with my typical that I had, who had a friend who was part of it. And they would play together, and he watched them, you know, would rise up, and it looked like they were just going to get so high they were going to kill each other. They suddenly stopped, walked around, came back, started at the lower end again.
Yeah, and that's really great when they can do that. They usually do that when they're playing with known play partners.
Yeah, my dogs used to do that.
Because if they play with dogs that they don't know, then one dog will stop and the other one won't.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful with that. Yeah. But yes, it's great when you can do that. And that's what we taught Luke and Boo. You know, Luke, they have to stop. They can't keep going. All right, I'm going to play one more video, and then I'm going to stop. So this is a video of a dog park. And this is a Spitz dog who's got a ball, and the pit mix would like it. Thank you very much. So is the pit bull walking away?
He's back.
It's a dog.
Teddy. Teddy.
You can't have my ball. You can't have it. Yeah. I'm gonna go away. Started to have a good time, you know, because oh boy, you know, most dogs, if the Spitz had gone, they'd go, oh, okay, I'm sorry. But because of this dog's going to take every challenge, you know, like, oh, this is good, this is going to be fun.
His owner was on it.
Yeah,
oh, they were on it. They were early on it. These are good owners here.
Yeah,
these are,
so
but
fun.
If he hadn't, how would they have gotten this hard from it?
Well, they've had to have to do it. Somebody would have to do that, because the thing is that I think in this case the pit mix probably would have just was just having such a good time she would have kept on going.
Yeah.
You know?
So were you
really part of
her? Huh?
You were videoing it.
Not
so
me. One of my students was.
Okay, so had this been a problem, an issue? Why was this being videoed?
Because my students. That's when I did the 40-hour course. Everybody had to go and go to a dog park and observe.
Okay.
And that is one of the best ways to learn. Go to a dog park without your dog. Without your dog. And observe at the dog park. And try to do it, you know, a couple times so that you can see a variety of different things. One of my students saw somebody's leg being broken when he was run into by a dog. And a lot of people have seen fights. I think there was one other fight here.
What are you writing down and oh, she was really upset. Who are you?
You know her
so this blue
no,
guy,
no idea.
Is going after the boxer man.
Everything from pure
and the owner of the blue
pit boxer and boxer terrier. All the above.
And there is no problem for it. He does ask whether everything's okay. This is a little bit less cut and dry than the other one.
Yeah,
but the boxer mix is not having a good time.
He's got had some weird mutation, like one of her ears was on backwards. Yeah, if you want me to call her off, I'll pull her off and go to the other side. He seemed to like it.
Okay, so she's going back to the other now. She's standing over there on the phone. Oh, great.
Mom saved me.
And this is actually fairly common for a dog to target one dog. So why do you think that might be?
Well, it's figured out that it's dominant. It was fun and nobody saw
it. I don't think it has anything to do with dominance. This is prey drive. Because dominance is always in a relationship. Dominance is, I mean, it can be in a very quick relationship where two dogs start to, you know, do this kind of thing. So, but dominance doesn't have anything to do with fighting usually, except if they've sparred a bit. If it's just an attack like this, it's not generally dominance. Generally, it's predatory drive or they're having a good time. So what I think this is, I think this is a very, very old instinct having to do with cutting out the weak link in a herd and then going after that. That's what you've seen wolves do in the National Geographic shows and stuff like that. They cut out the weakest one and then they just keep going for that one. So I think that's what this has a relation to. So you see the one dog being picked on over and over again. I think that's it.
You see that in puppy groups.
Yeah, where they'll just kind of go after one dog.
Yeah.
They get
in chase. There's always the leader and whether everybody's
goes after one. Yep. All right, let's take a quick break here, 10 minutes or so.